are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend. You are very welcome to Book Lovers Cafe. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. This program is all about authors, their books, and their lives. So today, we're going to be talking to Rebecca Anderson about her new novel, The Grand Promise. It's set in the northeast corner of Washington, along the Columbia River. And it's set also in the 1930s, around Kettle Falls, and all about the Grand Coulee Dam. It's a historical fiction family saga with lots of derring do and cliffhangers for those who love a fast-moving plot. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad that you're here. I really love this book. My listeners know I love historical fiction, and so I was not disappointed by this book.
Oh, I'm thrilled to hear that.
Yeah. You know, I tell people that it's about the Grand Coulee Dam, and they go, oh, you know, I'm not so sure I want to read that. But then I tell them more, and they go, oh, that sounds really good. So it's called The Grand Promise, and it's set here in Washington. And let's find out more about it. So, Rebecca, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, this story is loosely based on my family history. And what inspired me to write the book, I went on a road trip to the family homestead with my mom, and she was explaining to me how the town where my grandfather grew up didn't exist anymore because it was under the Columbia River, because it had been backed up behind the Grand Coulee Dam. And I had never heard of such a thing and was very intrigued by this idea. And the more research I did, the more it seemed like a story that needed to be told about the communities that were affected there. And it imagines what would have been like for these people to go through this transition.
Mm-hmm. So Kettle Falls is a site of a historic native fishing license. It's like was known for hundreds of miles. So you did involve Native people in the story as well, did you not?
I did. It's mostly based on my family history, but you can't really tell the story without talking about the impacts to the Native community there. And I actually had some great conversations with staff on the Colville Reservation and got some advice from them. They had great resources on their website that I used for historical facts. It was important to me to include that story along with the story of the towns.
Yeah, so not only the historical facts, but you write about this family. So there's a lot of family relationships and dynamics and, you know, human beings are flawed. No one's perfect. And not, you know, I think about your main character, Carter. Why don't you tell us about Carter Price?
Carter Price is in his late 20s. He has a divorce pending. He's lost his job. His career is faltering. And he's just sort of wandering and trying to figure out what's next. He has a very overbearing father. They have a tense relationship. His mother passed away years before, and he's having to live at home now. So he's like in this state of unraveling a little bit and trying to find his way and really looking for a fresh start in life.
It seems like just a case of an unfortunate incident that sort of snowball into disaster for Carter.
Yeah.
Your heart really goes out to him, but you're not sure whether you're going to like him or not. Okay, so not only do you have the Price family, but there's a big issue going on in the town of Kettle Falls, a big issue for everyone. And so I'd like you to read a little bit, which is, well, you introduce it. Go ahead.
So the town learns in a town hall meeting that their town is going to be flooded by this hydroelectric project that's being built far, far downriver from them. And it's shocking to everyone. And many people are going to lose their homes and businesses. Nobody knows who yet or what kind of compensation they're going to get for it. But it's also during the Great Depression. So there are many people who are without work who are excited about the potential jobs that are going to be created by this. So the town is completely split on the pros and cons of this project coming. It's a big deal, though. It was historically, this was a very significant event. They opened the bid publicly, and it was kind of a big shakeup that the company who won the bid for the project got it. So the local press was covering this very closely. So I have a fictional character named Harold Burns, who is an up-and-coming reporter who is covering this project in hopes that it's going to move him on to bigger and better things. So after he attends this town hall meeting, he submits his story the next morning. So I'll read this passage. Harold Burns from the Colville Scintilla rode home as fast as his horse would move to get his story filed. Town's response reveals character, says company rep. Comparing the construction of the dam at milepost 90 off Highway 20 to a Great War battlefield, the representative from Stark's company told the Scintilla that Kettle Rapids' response to his announcement would, quote, reveal their true character, end quote. In this exclusive interview prior to the public announcement on Wednesday, M.J. Starks went on to say that outcomes of such a project are, quote, always worth it, end quote, apparently ignoring the fact that one outcome is the displacement of more than 500 family homes, businesses, and civic buildings. Members of the Colville tribe held a silent protest outside, noting another outcome as the loss of millions of salmon and traditional sites along the river. Citing, quote, eventual outcomes, end quote, to a surly mob as the prize to keep their eyes on, surely Mr. Starks meant the access to irrigation water and not the loss of land, timber, food sources, traditional lands, and structures. Perhaps he forgets sometimes the eventual outcome can mean catastrophic loss of life as well. Take, for instance, the failure of the St. Francis Dam in Los Angeles, California, a decade ago. Only 2 years after its completion, the dam collapsed, releasing its reservoir in a flood that killed 600 people. Kettle Rapids' response? A shouting match.
Okay, that really sets the stage. And, you know, the way our country is now, you can imagine what it was like then. This is in the mid-30s during the Depression. And so, you know, just history repeats itself. So there's a confrontation. But this presents an opportunity for Carter, our character. What happens to him next?
Carter gets an invitation from head of the development company to come work at the dam, even though he knows his father is adamantly opposed to the project because it's going to affect their family ferry business. He's looking for his way, and this becomes an opportunity for him to start over, have a new life, get away from his hometown, and kind of escape some of these problems that he's had.
Yeah, so we're on the way to the dam. And before we get there, I just want to say that you can really feel what these places look like. You can hear them, you can smell them. And so on the way, before he goes, he ends up visiting his cousin Lloyd. Can you read the description of what it's like in Lloyd's barn?
Carter, you want to join me in the barn? Lloyd's barn was a place anyone would want to be. For years during Prohibition, he kept a homemade wine barrel there, big enough to keep himself and his friends in libations when they had occasion. He built a bar area with a card table, chairs, and a pipe-vented wood stove. Out here, no one bothered him, least of all the sheriff, who'd been known to make a visit to the barn himself. Lloyd and Carter bundled up, and the dog padded along with them, her ears alert as if they were on an errand of grave importance. Even though it was still early, the sky was dark and gray, and the pine trees were silhouettes against the clouds. Inside the barn, Carter pulled off his gloves and rubbed his hands together, the quickening of blood warming his skin. The cows shuffled in their stalls, and Lloyd stoked up the fire he kept going in the barn to warm the cows. The room glowed a wheat gold, and down the stretch of stalls, honey-colored jersey faces peered at them, huge brown eyes black in the dimness, noses raised and curious. It was more than a year since the ban on alcohol had been officially repealed, but it was still gratifying to enjoy something you'd made yourself. It might not be past noon, Lloyd said, but what the hell, it's Christmas. He set a small cup of homemade wine in front of Carter, and the firelight twinkled in the burgundy liquid. Was that a toast or a prayer, Carter asked. Maybe a little of both. The dog collapsed protectively at Lloyd's feet, and he stroked her ears. Carter took a sip. A cow murmured deep in the barn, and the dog looked alert for a moment, then settled her head back on her paws. Do you think the water will come up this high? Carter asked Lloyd as he took a sip. Hard to say. Isn't that unsettling for you? Some. I built it before. I can build it again. Carter was impressed by his confidence. What about Marie? That must really have her turned out. She knows I'll take care of us. Carter thought about this for a moment. Had he taken care of May? Had she told him to leave because she didn't have confidence in him like that anymore? At least she believes in you, Carter said. Are we still talking about me? Carter smiled and stared into his wine, took a sip. I suppose not. You and May, it was different. How do you mean? I know you were happy in the beginning. You were so proud of the hard work you did and you and your dad did to pay for and build that house for her. Did she even want it? Lloyd was quiet for a moment, scratching the dog behind her ears like he was thinking of the right words. In the end, there was never any place besides each other to aim your focus. Marie and I, we have the boys and the cows and the house. There's always been something else we have to work on together. It changes things when you're supporting lives. Carter nodded, but the truth was he'd never been responsible for a life other than his own, and May's to some extent. Don't you ever wish it was just you two? He asked. Lloyd grinned, the dog at his feet, the rows of dove-eyed cows behind his back. Not a bit, he said. What could be better than this? When he put it like that, it did make all of Carter's anguish seem petty and small, like the thin strip of hay floating on the surface of his wine.
I'd love to hang out in that bar with Lloyd. Yeah. You're listening to KPTZ, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. We're talking today to Rebecca Anderson, and she has been reading and talking about her new novel, The Grand Promise. So Carter's on his way. He sleeps rough. He walks most of the way from Kettle Falls down to the dam site. And I'd like you to sort of paint us a picture of what it's like when he first gets there.
He finds a group of men at a gas station and pays them $1 for a ride to the dam site. So this is after he has now arrived. The truck dropped Carter and the rest of the men off close to dark at the Bureau of Reclamation's Administration Building in Engineerstown. The truckload of workers that Carter came to town with was not the first or only group of their sort to arrive at the site. A line of them stretched out the door of the building, waiting restlessly in the cold, wanting to know what kind of work could be had. Carter pressed around them, trying to keep his knapsack and tackle bag out of the way, hoping to see what was happening inside the offices. The room was filled with men like him. Two tables had several rosters, and men from the project sorted the potentials. Locals on one list, Washington residents from outside the area on another, skilled labor from out of state on one, black men, Chinese men, and members of the local tribes on a separate list. A man in a work shirt and suspenders blocked Carter's way. "Line starts back there," he said, pointing several yards down the crowded queue. Carter looked down the length of the line, the haggard faces anxious for some indication of hope. In Ralph's bar, Stark said they needed people like Carter. In the meeting, Stark said men from the flooded towns would be at the top of the list. "Mr. Stark's told me to come," Carter handed the man Stark's creased business card he'd kept in his wallet. The man in suspenders looked at the card and glanced over Carter's bags. Carter realized he must look rumpled and dirty from his days of walking and nights of sleeping on the ground since he left home. "How do you know Mr. Stark's?" "I'm from Kettle Rapids." Carter had no idea if this would help or hurt him, but he was willing to take a chance. The man took a clipboard from a nail on the wall. "What's your name, son?" "Carter Price." The man wrote on the list, "What are you good at?" Carter hesitated, thinking of his recent failures, and the man looked up quickly from his clipboard. "I have a long line of people here waiting for work." "I worked in the Colville mica mine, sir, and for my father's ferry business." The man lowered his clipboard. "Go to the Starks Company offices in Electric City tomorrow, Price. See what they can do for you." He hung the clipboard back up with a sigh. Carter wandered away from the line, trying to ignore the resentful looks shot his way. The homes around the administration building looked well kept. They lined a ridge overlooking the river and tapered up a shallow hill that butted against shimmering icy rocks. Carter rubbed his shoulders for warmth, grateful he'd taken his father's coat before he even knew he was headed this way. He wished there was a dry spot he could drop his bags to give his back a rest. He walked toward the river to where the road met a washed-out bridge. The shore on the other side was dotted with a haphazard city of shacks, its alleys muddy and quiet. He walked back toward the administration building. A cluster of men stood away from the line, smoking cigarettes, their breath puffs of steam and smoke. "You fellas know where to get a drink and some food around here?" He would have to watch his funds until he found work, but the walk had left him famished. One of the men pointed south. "Head up to B Street," he said. "You'll find what you need there." The men snickered, smoke billowing from their mouths.
B Street. What could be there? You describe so many places just within this, you know, dam site. Shack Town, Electric City, the bunkhouse, and then, of course, the catwalk over the river. Are these real or imagined? How did you make these come to life?
These were historical places. They don't exist anymore, but there are lots of photos in the state archives of them. And so I actually made several trips out there, but also did a lot of online research and looking at those historical photos and trying to capture those images in the story.
Mm-hmm. So do you keep a journal? Do you write, you know, just when things inspire you, or do you mostly keep going on the plot? What's your process?
The process is kind of layered, actually. I started with just like the simple story of Carter and then really tried to build in the plot and the scenery. And it was funny, you mentioned this Greek myth theme to it. And I actually used a book called The Writer's Journey that shows you how to set plot along like the three-act structure of the hero's journey. And it really helped me develop the plot in a way that there are steps that you go through along the story.
Right. I thought that one of the themes of this book, it seemed like the journey of someone trying to find himself. And, you know, that led me to think about O Brother, Where Art Thou, which was also based and taken from the Iliad, you know, Ulysses' journey to try to find his way home. So here he is, Carter Price, trying to find his way home, a man who's flawed, but also has some potential. So here in this camp, he meets a native man, Joe Mainzer, who breaks a lot of stereotypes. Tell us about Joe.
Intentionally, yes. Joe, both Lloyd and Joe serve as sort of mentor figures for Carter. He is, you know, sort of listing about trying to find his way and finds these men who serve as sort of examples of what he would like to be more like. Joe also presents him with an opportunity for a side hustle, helping make money in sort of the off season and as the work is slows down in the winter time. And they become friends. Joe is very cool, has a robust social scene that Carter wants to be a part of. And so he sort of slowly convinces Joe to be friends with him over time.
One of the things about Joe, as which I, you know, my eyes sparkled at, was he goes over. Joe is not living at the bunkhouse. He's living in his own place in Shacktown. And they go over there one night, and, you know, usually there's like troublemaking going on, but he goes into Joe's and they're playing this game. And tell us about that game.
They compete against one. Well, and I'll tell you why I put this. I did not want it to just be like a cliche poker game, right? That I wanted there to be an opportunity for Carter to kind of get into the, make friends at the dam. But they are competing against one another to memorize and recite passages from books that they love. And Joe has a stack, and they bet against each other. And Joe has a stack of books. He gives one to the two competitors. They memorize and recite their passages, and then he picks a winner, and then, you know, everybody, like, settles up on their bets.
So there's passages from Brave New World and, you know, some other kind of big historical books, and that is really, that is really cool, and I sort of would like to dare my family to have one of these recitation games. That'd be fun. So another theme and another way you set the scene is through the celebrations in this book. It's not all sort of grimy down in the, you know, on the river or down down the mine or blasting, but there's some real, you know, human celebrations. Tell us about one of those. What's your favorite?
My favorite is at the very end of the book, and I'm trying to think of how to talk about it without giving anything away. One of my favorite scenes is when they all get together for a dinner and Carter is getting to reconnect with people he hasn't seen in a long time and is finally sort of feeling like he's coming into his own and gets to demonstrate that in front of people he knows.
Right.
Many of the celebrations or the group scenes in the book were really to bring all the characters back together. You see a lot of them on their own, in their own worlds, and how the project is affecting them. But there are some big scenes where they're all part of, like Franklin D. Roosevelt comes out to the dam, and there's a huge groundbreaking ceremony with tens of thousands of people. Mm-hmm. And so it made sense to me that all of these characters would want to attend
that. Would be
that.
There, yeah. Right.
And then I'm stuck with the, you know, dilemma of what to do with them now that they're all in the same, you know, space together. How's
well,
that going
to
go?
We won't tell, but it was pretty exciting. But there was also a big gathering at a place called The Fort.
Yes. Fort Spokane is a real place. And in around
did
this
did you go
time,
there and wander around?
I did. Most of the buildings are gone. They've had some fires there. And then it is true that there were people living at the fort who were squatting at the fort. It was abandoned by the military, used as a hospital for a while, and then just kind of left for many years. And so people were living there.
Mm-hmm.
I invented a lot of what, you know, what
I
took
know,
place there.
Trading but it, with the Indians.
Yeah, that was all invention.
Horses, yeah.
But there was a history that happened there of people living at the fort.
Uh-huh. It was a boarding school, too. It sort of reminded me a little bit of Fort Worden.
Oh, yeah.
But there's, you know, the scene where it's the colonel's birthday, mm-hmm. and there's an orchard, mm-hmm. and there's people that come and play music, and everybody brings something to eat.
I really wanted to paint it as this idyllic place because he's coming from sort of gritty, hard work, dangerous environment, and then kind of lands in this little paradise that's got a little hint of danger to it, but it is kind of a paradise, and it captures his attention, like it captures his imagination and makes him want to stay.
Yeah, you just don't know which way he's going to go. It's
right.
another one of those turning points where it's fascinating for the reader to try to figure out what to do, what's going to happen, you know, which is very interesting what he chooses. So he spends some time on his own and he thinks about everything. And then it comes that you know, resilience seems to be a big theme mm-hmm. For you and for Carter. So what does he eventually settle on as a plan?
After a series of things that happened to him, he decides that it's time for him to go home and start over.
Mm-hmm.
And that he, you know, has sort of repaired his self-esteem in some ways through these series of experiences. And I think that that passage that I read in Lloyd's barn where Lloyd talks about that he wouldn't be afraid of this because he would just do it again. He's done it before, he can do it again. And, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes life throws you a curveball and you dust yourself off and start over.
Right.
And so he really carries that message to Carter,
mm-hmm.
Which is very counter to what Carter's father says, which is like, you should protect what you have at all costs,
mm-hmm.
Because you can't, it's too hard to start over.
Mm-hmm.
So those are kind of the two conflicting philosophies of the characters that he's closest to.
That's right. So it's a long book. It's a very exciting book. I want to again congratulate you and ask you, what's next for you? What are you going to do? What are you thinking about writing?
I actually have about 200 pages of another novel that is also historical fiction, but it's set in Germany and Russia a little bit earlier in the 1930s, and two women whose lives are sort of intersect, but having concurrent experiences during that time period.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Have you been over there?
I have, yes. Mm-hmm.
So that's good. So I'm looking forward to reading that book and feeling those places as well. And you also have a connection with Empty Bowl and Michael Daly. So how did that happen and get your book published?
Yeah, Empty Bowl is the publisher of this book. It's their first novel and my first novel, which is exciting. And Michael Daly was my editor. So I was connected to Michael through another Empty Bowl writer, and sent him the first, I think, section of the book to read. And he thought it fit with the mission of Empty Bowl. And he was excited to take on a novel. And
That's
the
good.
Rest is history.
Yes. They're good friends of ours in here at KPTZ, Finn Wilcox and Michael Daly. So thank you very much for joining us today, Rebecca. You've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and we've been talking to Rebecca Anderson, and she has written a book called The Grand Promise. Please join me next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson. You can listen to past shows and other programs from the podcast page on the website, kptz.org, and you can make a donation to the station there as well. Thank you very much to Nora Petrich, who is helping us in the booth today, and to all the volunteers and supporters who make this wonderful radio station possible. See you next time.